That wasn't exciting. This is Soft Revolution, the podcast. My name is Torkel Campbell.
I'm Ali Moman.
And today on the pod, we have, I believe, our very first guest ever has returned after a long, emotional, bumpy road. Michael Healy, our dear friend, a great writer, a great actor. I've just seen him act recently, and I had forgotten how funny and how real and how great he is at acting. He is back to talk with us about the wettest damp squib I've ever seen in my whole darn life. And that's saying something because I've seen a lot of shows at the Stratford Festival. Just kidding. I kid because I love everyone. The federal election in Canada last night. We're back to where we were $600 million ago. And we have exactly the same government virtually. And we're going to talk about why that happened and what it was all for and whether it was worth it and what has been surprising. If anyone knows this, it's Michael, because he is a deep lover of parliamentarianism. He's a deep lover of politics. He loves the game. He loves the dialectic of it. And he's a great thinker about it. And he's funny about it, too. So we're really, really happy and honored to have Michael back with us right away. Michael, thank you for doing this. It really is lovely of you.
Jesus Christ. No pressure in terms
No pressure at all. I'm going to start with an easy question. Michael Healy, you have publicly exoriated me on Twitter and demanded my ouster from this podcast due to what you perceived as a level of irrationality you could no longer bear. Now that all my most hysterical prognostications have been proven correct, where are you taking me for lunch?
Wait. What are you talking about?
Just answer the question. Where are we going for lunch?
Anywhere you want, mister.
There you go.
Yeah.
No, honest but let's God. Talk about it. Let's okay. talk about it because you lost your shit on me. You join the pantheon of dear friends of mine who've finally been driven to the edge of their ability to cope. So no problem. I'm used to it. But what was it about what I was saying back then that made you so upset? How did I hurt you?
Well, we'll get the doll out and I can point to places on the doll's body. So here's my memory of that entire thing is that, it was a rough week for whatever reason. I was, yeah. you know, I'm feeling whatever I was feeling. And then I tuned into the Soft Rev podcast and you were on a tear about so many things. And just so many things. And you were kind of right up here and I was kind of halfway through it and I was thinking, well, that's not accurate. And why is he saying that and this and that? And I just felt myself getting more and more kind of sad. And I was like, this is not what I tune into this podcast for. So all I was begging for in that circumstance was for you to just apply a little bit more consciousness. My feeling was that week you had come on unprepared and had just spewed. And so I want the full torque. I want nothing but the torque. All I wanted that week was just a little more consciousness on your part because it was such a spray of negativity that I just wanted to kill myself at the end. And so often I turn to this podcast for a bit of bracing reality, a bit of amateur immunology and some decent art picks at the end, some positivity. So that's where I was that week.
I hear you. I'm sure that's happened and it's weird. Like it is a weekly, it can be very heavy lifting to get yourself out of where you are as a human, and into where you need to be as a person talking to an audience. And I think I've probably failed more than once at that. I go back and forth with myself about what to say on this podcast, how much of my, what I perceive to be my honest feelings to share, because as you say, like this thing has a purpose, it has a frame, and I certainly don't want to leave people without a sense of fight or leave people without a sense of hope. So for that, I apologize, you know, just not just for that week, but for basically my entire, I once wrote a song whose entire lyric was, "I'm sorry to everyone for everything I've ever done." And I just sing it over and over again. So maybe that'll be my art pick this week. But
well, I will say something I've noticed, Torque, is that, like, you know, we talk about immediacy bias. And, like, I think what's amazing about you, what makes you, like, the artist that you are, is that whatever you're feeling, whatever's, like, going on in your brain and your heart and your soul is just so profound and powerful that, like, it's impossible for you to not think that this, you know, melange of feeling and thinking is true, deep, and forever. And like, I get emails from you sometimes, like, I'll just say it, where it's like, whoa.
Yeah.
And what I do is I listen and I go, you know, there's like 80% sure, but there's also 20% I'm like, this just cannot be.
A friend of mine once said that I'm correct 82% of the time, which I think is a good average. I think it's dead on. I think he's absolutely right. But that leaves 18% of the time where I am profoundly wrong. So, you know, I don't know what to tell you.
You sent me a text right after this election. So I was just going to say, Michael, you sent me a text, you know, Torque, right after, you know, during this election. And, like, you know, the prognostications were, like, big, or, and we could talk about, like, what this election meant and everything like that. And it was huge. But what it got me thinking was, like, this notion of we speak so much, and this is probably for all of us, like, we got to veer away from, like, the immediacy bias.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that what we're thinking right now is forever. Unfortunately, nothing is forever.
Yeah.
And sometimes I think, you know, things, especially with this pandemic, you know, we get a bit of great news and you think it's forever and you think it's over. You get a bit of, like, crappy news and you think, well, it's going to be crap forever. But it's always somewhere in the middle. And, you know, I hate to sound like such a fucking, like, you know, left of center centrist, but here I am. But there's something down in the middle, you know, that's the most true.
Well, you know, blame my therapist. You know, he's trying his best, but he's obviously not up to snuff. Let's get to this election, because that's what Michael has been so kind to come and talk to us about. I mean, you are, I think it's safe to say, Michael, someone who follows politics in Canada the same way some people follow baseball. You know the stats, you know the minor league players, you really have an interest in the game of politics. What do you make of this complete non-event? What are your initial thoughts about why they did this? And has anything changed at all?
Well, nothing's changed, obviously, in terms of, you know, seat count and everything else. But the thing that has changed is that the Liberals, whether they have actually earned it or not, feel they've got a mandate for the next few years. And we'll see how long this lasts. I love an election. I always think it's a good idea. I don't buy the idea that the argument that it's $600 million wasted dollars because it's just not. It's how we communicate with each other in a kind of national basis. And if the communication that comes out of last night is, 58% of us, because that's how many of us voted, 58% of us are fine with the status quo. Go ahead, sport, and do your thing. Then I think that that's as valid a message as fuck off y'all. I just, you know, let's have a change election.
It's revolution time or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. I'm boring enough to think that this election is as interesting and valid as any.
Any. I agree with you. I agree with you.
But it does leave me with two kind of questions that I was thinking about earlier. And these are a little bit more as an observer. I have questions for Trudeau and for O'Toole. My first question for Trudeau is, you've won three elections. It's clear that people are getting a little tired of you. Is now the moment when you, you know, groom others to come up behind you, step aside and make for another leader? Now, that would be almost unprecedented in terms of Canadian politics. Nobody wins and then decides to step aside. You really, you know, the history of Canadian politics is leaders getting the absolute shit kicked out of them and then going, oh, I guess it's time to go now. People never see it coming. You know, Kathleen Wynne a couple of years ago had to have, you know, she had to be decimated before the Liberals got the message that, all right, it's time for a change election. So that's my question is, will he be smart enough? Will he have the people around him who have enough sense to understand that it's possible that his time is up, and that he should possibly consider anyway, the idea of stepping aside. So that's my question for him. My question for O'Toole is, for me, the Conservative Party is incredibly interesting at this moment. You've now had two elections where you had a guy who ran to the right in the last one. Mm-hmm. You've had a guy who's run to the center in this one, and you've had exactly the same outcome. Mm-hmm. So what are you to make of this? And my guess is, these are gross generalizations, but my guess is that there is a new kind of ceiling for the, my guess is that there is a new kind of ceiling for the Conservative Party in the country right now. And that they will never break through that ceiling unless they figure out a third, you know, a different way. Harper did, but Harper is the more I, you know, study history, the more I look at this guy, the more I see what's happening. He really does seem like a real outlier in terms of being able to galvanize people.
And he was pre-Trump, right? I mean, this is to me what seemed clear last night is the number of times I saw on the TV that a conservative might have taken a riding from a liberal had it not been for that 1500 votes that somebody from the PPC got.
But that's assuming that person would vote for the conservative. I hear that all the time. It's like, this is to suggest that those 1500 people would have shown up and they would have voted CPC. Let's take a little, let's take a little bit of them, but I don't think all of them. I think the people who vote PPC are voting PPC because they believe in that, you know?
Yeah. Otherwise they're staying home and,
yeah,
shining up their weapons and
they're on Facebook.
Let's be real. Yeah. Haven't the conservatives always had to have those people in their party in order to
win? They've always had to play footsie with them. Yes,
they not just play footsie, but Stephen Harper was a deeply, deeply right wing human being on a social level, on a cultural level. He talked about old stock Canadians. Those dog whistles are things those guys have gone back to now for a long, long time. And it seems to me that Erin O'Toole just didn't blow the whistles hard enough, and that the people who want that as their red meat went to the PPC and they were lost from the Conservatives. And that the whole politicization of the vaccine, non-vaccine question was bad for the Tories, because they can't come out and say the vaccines are made by Bill Gates and they're going to put a computer in your blood, because they're trying to be a mainstream party. But in fact, 20% of the people who are going to vote for them think that's true. So what the fuck do you do when 20% of your base is nut bars?
It's the same mistake that Ford made initially in respect to the passports, where he said, no, I'm not for them. And now he's for it because he realized that, no, people actually, you know, you have 85% higher, actually, if you go 18 and up, of the voting population, higher when you actually go to the people that do vote, who are 35 and up. Like, we're in the 90% of these people who have gotten vaccines. So it's politically stupid for you to not actually be for these vaccinations and passports. And I think the big mistake that O'Toole made was that he didn't say, you know what, I want everyone to be vaccinated. If there's going to be people who disagree with me, that's fine, but I want vaccine passports. I think that would have really helped him in this election.
He made a political decision. And that's one of the brilliant things about Stephen Harper. I know that I'm the only person in the country that thinks that Stephen Harper is a brilliant individual. But one of the brilliant things about him was for him, politics trumped policy 95% of the time. He was totally concerned with acquiring and maintaining power. And he betrayed almost every value, almost everything that he believed in as a conservative to achieve power for 9 years, for almost 10 years.
Let me ask you this. Sorry, go ahead.
No,
I want to ask you this. Every time I see an election now, as an NDPer is what I perceive. You know, I don't even know anymore because there's so much. This pandemic has changed the political landscape so much. I don't know what to call myself anymore, frankly. Mm. But I am I'm a socialist, and so I associate myself with the NDP, who use that word more readily than other people do. But every election, I see, you know, 65% of the country are left wing, are liberal. Do you think that the NDP should quit? Should no, but like, is what's the solution? Is it a 6-party system? Like, I was looking at this and I was like, look at that stasis. Look at all that complete inertia. Everyone's, you know, got their corner and they're standing in it. Mm-hmm. How does this shift? Either the conservatives go far right and they open up the middle for the liberals, and the liberals are the governing party forever, or the NDP kind of disappear and the liberals are the, should there be fewer political parties in Canada? Should there be more? Or is this a good way of governing? Is this kind of stasis actually healthy?
Well, so my perspective is this, is that the reason I don't like electoral reform is because I believe that large brokerage parties like the Liberals, Conservatives, and the NDP, who are forced to try and figure out a platform that appeals to everybody across the country, actually binds the country in the way that the railway used to when it was created. That more parties will just lead to further fragmentation on regional basis. So my preference is always for, I love first past the post. I know I'm alone in this. I think it's shitty in a lot of ways, but it's the least worst option in terms of an electoral system. But I also believe that there is value in a country as big as ours, in a country as fragmented as ours, mm-hmm. having leaders who are forced to talk to every region of the country. How do you solve the NDP's problem? I don't know. What's your goal with the NDP? Do you want to make them, do you want the NDP to one day run the country? Do you want them to be the government one day? Their only choice is to
then they would just be the Liberals. They would just end up looking like the Liberals. If you want the NDP to like run the country, they would be like a center left party, like the Liberal Party. All right, Soft Revolution is brought to you by Effin' Birds, a book and webcomic. You know the drill.
And for the first time, Ali, I'm here. Yeah. I'm here to this ad with you. We've decided to up the ante. We're not.
Because you got a webcam now.
I got a webcam, and I'm feeling a little saucy, and we're upping the effing ante because we think Effin' Birds deserves both hosts, not just one.
Damn right.
So, okay, let's play this game.
So I have a card, and I'm going to show it to you right now, and I want you to describe to the people what this card is.
Okay. All right. It's a lovely ace of spades. It's got ace on either side, the A. And then
it has a heart.
Well, no, but then Ali, please. This is my first commercial. Let me get through this in peace. There's a lovely heart, a lovely red sort of classic Valentine's heart. Superimposed over which is a very, very regal, magnificent hawk. Is it a hawk? Is it an eagle? I'm not a bird guy. They frighten me a little, frankly. But it's some kind of giant bird of prey stretching its wings majestically over this red heart. If you're feeling romantic, hold on a second, because written underneath that is the aphorism, "Eat farts."
Damn right.
Now, is it eagle farts? Is that what they're saying? Is it heart farts? Where are the farts? Where are the farts coming from? These are the kind of existential questions you will ask yourself, people, if you involve yourself in Effin' Birds, if you invest in a pack of Effin' Birds playing cards or an Effin' Bird coffee cup. It's an endless black hole of bird-flavored
flatulence.
It's a fucked up thing, and that's why we're so proud to be sponsored by it. Because life's fucked up, and so is Effin' Birds.
I love it. I love it.
They would have to cherry pick from their liberals and the conservatives, and find and find a message and a leader that makes them viable across the country to one third of the country. Right now they're at 20% and they can't get anywhere.
And I said this before, you know, it really seems like the NDP, particularly Jagmeet, I mean, I really do like the guy, but here we are again, and really nothing has changed. Nothing has changed, no matter how many TikToks he does, no matter how many like Instagram, no matter how many times he's on that skateboard, it doesn't make a difference, right? So the question is really, it's like, why I'm not gonna lie, there was a part of me that was like, this election, what are we doing? You know, we're right back at square one. But to Michael's point, it's an opportunity for every single party, including the Liberals, but the Conservatives and the NDP, to get a sense of who they are. And I think the mistake that the NDP makes sometimes is that they do think, because they live in the world of like what is amplified on social media, what is exciting, they get like those type of metrics really hits them, that they start to drink their own kind of vibe so much that they actually think they're a lot more popular than they are. And elections are always this reminder to them or to any party to be like, no, actually, this is what people think of you. And it's important to face the voters to be either like shocked or to be humbled or to be, you know, reinforced. And I think that's the thing that I want the NDP to take from this, to be like, you know, listen, you have to start to connect to more people. And how do you do that? Otherwise, you're right. This stasis continues.
I would love to see some sort of numbers on how many people who frequently comment on politics on social media voted versus the number of people who voted who don't frequently comment on politics on social media, because
the actual silent majority.
Yeah, well, 5% of the population, or roughly thereabouts, uses Twitter, but 95% of the media and political class are on Twitter. So their idea of what is happening in the world has absolutely nothing to do with what is actually happening to people inside their little brains that they're using to get through the day. And I think that's, you know, you were talking, Ali, before the election about don't trust the polls. Don't. Well, they were kind of accurate in this case, in the sense that they called it exactly the same as the last time. But I don't think that had anything to do with what the conversation was online. Like, it didn't reflect in any way. There were rocks being thrown at the – if you read online what the Canadian election was, it was like, Jesus, we're on the edge of insurrection here. We've got a white supremacist party above 10%. We've got people throwing rocks at the prime minister. We got all this. But at the end of the day, none of that shit really mattered. That's a tiny group of people doing that stuff. So, Michael, I want to bring this to culture because that's part of our brief here. Is it just, was that election proof that the culture war is a war that's only being fought by a very small group of people and that everybody else really doesn't care about this stuff?
I tend to agree with that. I struggle with everybody who watches the news or has opinions about this stuff. I struggle with exactly how much play the People's Party gets. You know, for me, they are like the kidneys of the Conservative Party. Like, they flush, the People's Party catches the toxins, you know, flushes them out, just kind of, you know, holds on to them or gets them out. And that's really their function. I'll be curious to see, you know, obviously they took more votes this time than they did in 2019. I will be interested to see, and my suspicion is that they will not, that they will, that this is their peak and that they will be less relevant in elections going forward post-pandemic. That a lot, that they're responsible for galvanizing a lot of the kind of inchoate rage in the country that has to do with vaccines and shutdowns and masks and all that shit. Which gets fed through social media and turbocharged. But my suspicion is, and, you know, I hope I'm right, that they will just be less and less relevant as the pandemic recedes. On the other hand, you know, as the climate turns to shit, they might just pivot to being climate, you know,
deniers
and, you know, survivalists, and that, and they could catch a lot of people that way. So, anyway,
a sister of a friend of mine, voted PPC and is a, you know, old left-wing hippie, but is an anti-vaxxer. Wow. And, right. you know, believes right. the vaccine's really evil and refuses to get the vaccine. And so voted PPC. So I think you're right, Michael. A lot of that boost came from people not knowing what the hell the rest of their platform stood for. They just knew that this was the party that was saying no more lockdowns, no more vaccines, blah, 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 blah. So I hope too that that will be a temporary blip, but I do think that the more it's this vicious circle of the media paying attention to the most extreme voices online, and then the political class paying attention to the media, and then the political class reacting to this tiny cesspool of extremity. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be a big problem. And I don't know how any governments tackle that without being accused of censorship and without being accused of crushing people's right to free speech, which, you know, is becoming less and less, I think, something one can argue for. Frankly, I think a little less free speech would do us all good. But I don't know.
I think it's fine. I do. I think that these people will retreat to the margins. Maybe I'm being naive. You know, I'm really, a lot of my opinions were forged pre-social media. But I think that, you know, these people have always been here. I think they'll go back to the margins once it's no longer fun to turn up at a rally for idiot in the flower shirt, and then they'll just, you know, they'll retreat to their subreddits, and for the most part, obviously.
But what happens if, like exactly what happened with the Republican Party, that, you know, let's say O'Toole resigns and they have a leadership convention. And all of a sudden you get somebody who is a conservative, you know, but has the kind of, you know, vibe of the PPC that speaks in that code. And there are certain members inside the Conservative Party currently that sure. will do that. That's my fear. The thing with Trump was that he finally legitimized it. He wasn't he was the real deal.
Yeah, but and he was a joke that's, when that's he showed up, right? He was a joke when he rode down that elevator.
He was a joke to us. He was a joke to us. But because he was able to galvanize a huge swath of people inside the Republican Party, that actually the people were feeling it. So I kind of wonder, like, what would happen if there's another leadership convention, which likely might happen, and we get, like, you know, like an alt-right kind of guy who speaks in the code.
Well, he right. better speak French. That's the great thing about Quebec is, like, if he doesn't speak French, it doesn't matter because he ain't going to win. And that is the perverse magic of Canada, is that we have this thing stuck in the middle of it where it's like, wait a minute, do you speak French? And if you don't speak French, let's talk about the Green Party, Michael, because I wanted to get your thoughts about this. I was really sad to see what happened throughout the whole campaign with Annamie Paul, who I think is quite a brilliant person, and her loss, like big time loss, finishing fourth in her riding. The Greens picked up two seats, but one of them was Elizabeth May, so it doesn't really count because I think she could literally be dead and still win that seat. Do you think they're a viable party going forward? Or it goes back, to my question about, you know, the Liberals, the NDP, the Greens. Are they not essentially the same party? And will people not just continue to vote for the Liberals as long as they think they're the ones with the best chance of winning?
Right. Yeah, probably they will. But that doesn't mean that we can't hold them to a standard to the standards that we want. I'm at a moment when the climate is such a central issue, at a moment when, you know, it's possible the pivot moment might have passed for really turning the corner on the crisis. The fact that the Green Party in Canada is almost completely irrelevant makes me profoundly sad. You know, it's viable in so many places in Europe, and it's dragging that conversation. Mm-hmm. to them in Europe. And the fact that we don't have that voice in the mix here is really sad. I don't know anything about the internal politics of the party, but it really does seem like, you know, amateur hour at the moment when we need them to be pros on top of the game. But to return to the conservatives for a moment, my favorite, you know, my favorite conversation point. How tough
You're like a man obsessed with a woman that doesn't want to have anything to do with him. He just keeps writing. You're like Cyrano de Bergerac.
That's exactly
but with
right.
The Erin O'Toole is the pretty girl.
It's the saddest thing. But how tough must it be to be a conservative in this country? And you just watch, you know, 2/3 of the country is not on your side. So for you to win, you have to be perfect. Meanwhile, Trudeau can shit the bed for 2 weeks, finally wake up and go, oh, it's an election, get his shit together and, you know, and then pound the piss out of you. How crazy must it be for you to be a conservative and say, we occupy everything from the center right all the way over to the extreme right, except for these people now, and we still can't get any purchase. You know,
so why is that?
The left is why, kind of, because we're a progressive country. That's all.
But there are, like, if you were to try to go for, you know, conservatives have won in Quebec before, right? Mulroney won in Quebec. And conservatives have a real shot at capturing the same kind of voter that Doug Ford and Rob Ford got in the 905, namely first generation immigrants, right? People who come from maybe religiously conservative backgrounds, socially conservative backgrounds, just because they're of color doesn't mean they necessarily skew left. But they seem to be completely unable to do that. They can't like rub their belly and pat their head at the same time. They want to do this chat with the Rosedale set and talk about old stock Canadians and run largely white candidates. But how are you going to win a country that's multicultural, that's filled with people who just got here, if you can't put someone up of color who has any kind of charisma or go get it? They don't have anybody. They got nobody on their bench.
It's true. The bench is not deep over there. And, you know, I think there are a lot of people who are on the sidelines just waiting for now they've had two elections where Trudeau has just kind of run the table. I think a lot of people looked at Trudeau in 2015 and went, I don't want a piece of that. I want that guy to burn himself out. I want him to go away before I step in. So you've got, you've got people like John Baird, you've got people, Rona Ambrose, who are standing on the sidelines, who are credible political forces, intelligent people, and just waiting for Trudeau to kick the shit out of people until he gets tired of kicking, and then they'll step in. You know, that's my guess. I don't really know. I don't have a mainline. I don't have a red phone to the Conservative Party. I don't talk to them.
Not yet, but stay obsessed. You might get one. Why don't you run for political office? Ali is running for political office. You're obviously someone with a passion for the country and for politics. Have you thought about it? And why do you think more people like you don't run?
I have thought about it. I admire Ali so very much.
Me too.
I want to help Ali Mohman get to Queen's Park as fast as he can. I don't run because I don't like people.
That's a great slogan. Michael Healy, I don't like people. I think people would respond to that.
I'm exhausted by a party. I'm not energized by a party. And so the idea that I would go and meet people and be cheerful with them and friendly, I can do it. I'm a relatively
talking about an actual party. When you say party, you mean party?
No. I mean like a party. Like come to our house at 10 o'clock, and we'll have a glass of wine. And you know, my wife loves it and is always thrilled to be invited to a party. And I'm like, all right, I'm going to need 48 hours after the party just by myself because it's exhausting. So that's it. I'm not an extrovert. I have a lot of passion for the political system and for particularly for policy, for particularly what's possible in a country like ours. Because I think we're firing on four or five, six out of eight cylinders in this country in terms of the things that we could achieve as a middle power in the world, the things that we could achieve for each other. And so I do have a lot of passion in that way. I was telling Ali yesterday that one of the things I did do a couple of years ago now was I applied for a Senate seat because Trudeau changed the requirements for getting a Senate seat, and he's opened it up so that only independents he only appoints independents, not Liberal Party members, to the Senate, and they're appointed, they're not elected. So I would sidestep the whole having to shake people's hands thing. And the Senate in the last few years has become an extraordinarily effective second look at legislation in this. I can talk about the Senate for an hour or two about how revolutionary the change has been in the Senate in terms of it actually fixing and helping legislation that comes from the House of Commons. And so without really knowing it, Canadians have been better served in the last few years than they have in the 155 prior to that. So.
Crow's Theatre announced its 2021-22 season on August 31st and will be welcoming vaccinated in-person audiences back to Streetcar Crow's Nest at Dundas and Carlaw in Toronto later this month. All season long, Crow's is offering discounted tickets to all individuals ages 30 and under. To participate in the U30 ticket program, visit crowstheatre.com and sign up to receive a promo code for $20 tickets to regular season shows. And if you sign up before September 22nd, you can attend preview performances of Cliff Cardinal's radical retelling of Shakespeare's As You Like It for just $10. Previews run September 22nd through the 29th, so sign up to be a part of U30 at Crow's Theatre today. Get your proof of vaccine ready and show some love to the arts.
So you love politics. You hate parties, and also you're not a party guy. You're just not a party guy.
Yeah,
you're just not a party guy.
That's right. Yeah, I'm not a party guy. I'm not. I love the most fun I have is, there's such a gap between what people of goodwill in politics, what they aspire to, and what they're actually able to do, because politics and policy are always in tension. It fed a lot of my art because that tension is always there. Politics, first of all, is the stakes are immediate and obvious. So it's easy to build stories around politics. But the idea of a politician aspiring to some method of improving people's lives and being thwarted by the cross currents of politics is endlessly fascinating to me. So I think about that a lot.
And I'm really interested to ask you this question. Like, historically, who has been able to do that the best? Who has been able to maintain their ideals, maintain their dignity, their integrity? Who has, been able to do great things, but maintain a good person? Who?
Well, my personal feeling about political leaders, at least, let's say, is that they are, if you don't leave politics with everybody hating you, then you didn't do your job. The point is to acquire as much political capital as possible and then spend it. Like, burn through every piece of goodwill that you've ever...
FDR did that.
Exactly. To do the things that you want to do. There are a few who... the thing that disappoints me most about Justin Trudeau is that he had acquired so much momentum in 2015, and he frittered quite a bit of it away. They achieved some great things in their first term, before the 2019 election. But to my mind, they could have gone balls to the wall, hard as anything, on the things that they wanted to achieve. And the things that aren't vote getters, like reconciliation is not a vote getter in the country. So whenever you're wondering why these people say they want to do something and then they end up falling short, like water on reserves is a great example. They've done more than any government in my lifetime on water on reserves. But the problem isn't over. They said it would be over. One of the reasons why, apart from the fact that infrastructure on reserves is just such a difficult, gnarly problem, and water is only one part of that problem, but one of the reasons why they didn't achieve it is because it's not a vote getter. So they want to make it a priority, but other things that actually are vote getters wind up in the kind of hierarchy of the things they choose to do, it gets pushed down the list a little bit. It's just inevitable when you are, when you're, well, that's why progressives disappoint people so often, you know, so goddamn much, so all the time. It's because they're constantly struggling with, I want to achieve something versus I want to get reelected.
Wow, that reminds me of Obama in 2009, what you're talking about.
For sure.
How he came in with so much political capital. He had the Congress. He had close to essentially a supermajority in the Senate. Yeah. And you're right, he should have gone balls to the wall. And this is why I think we need more artists in politics, because I will tell you this, we are grateful for the job. And we never believe in permanence when we have it. If it's what, one day on set, thank you so much. I'm going to do my best. Do I have one line? Thank you so much. And I think you're right. When you start to think about, oh, this, I have to be in this thing forever. Do you? Do you really have to be in this thing forever? And to think that way is probably a detriment.
I think a leader has to think that.
The thing that strikes me about the reconciliation thing is, like, once again, I'm left thinking, how does this happen unless, I don't know, 30% of the seats in Parliament are Indigenous seats? I mean, until we actually mandate power to Indigenous people, we can talk and talk and apologize, but until the wealth and the land and the power is redistributed, is there anything that a Liberal government or a Conservative government or an NDP government can do to really shift things for Indigenous people in the doesn't that have to come with their own agency, with their own place to sit in the halls of power?
Well, two thoughts. One is, it took 160 years to really fuck it up, and it's not going to be fixed in a 4-year period. It's a long sustained fight to make these people with whom we share this land, to get them out of the hole that we made.
Right.
And one of the things about being a senator is if you're not interested in getting reelected, you can actually focus. Senators are appointed to age 75. So you can look at every piece of legislation that comes to you from the House of Commons, and you can say, does this further or does it hinder the question of reconciliation? And you can amend a bill to achieve the things that you decide that you want to achieve in a kind of a long-term basis. Reconciliation and the climate are two things that absolutely are going to be our long-term issues, and so I think the Senate is uniquely positioned to be leaders on those. But to answer your question, yes. There's a vast, there's a high percentage of the Indigenous population that wants nothing to do with the Canadian power structure, and that's a barrier to transferring power to Indigenous people. You know, they don't want to be invited into the House of Commons.
Right. The solution isn't in that system for them.
No, they want to be land back, and let's have a real legitimate nation-to-nation relationship. So that's one of the barriers. And obviously there are other barriers, among Indigenous people who believe that they can actually change our system from within. There are massive barriers to them getting elected, and they should be encouraged. They should be, you know, it's part of the calls to action from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission is to find ways to put Indigenous people into political structures.
That's such a really good point. I've spoken to a lot of people and they say, you know, now that we're talking about $10 a day childcare and all these issues, it's like, where do you think this came from? And if you Occam's razor it, it's just, well, there's just more women in the room. And when you have more women in the room, all of a sudden ideas of childcare, ideas of, you know, fertility or whatever, these new things show up. Yeah. They just show up. Yeah.
So what do you expect from this government? More of the same? Are they going to be more, like, to me, I'm just a regular schmo here, but this election, like every election, represents some sort of turning point, even if it's back to the same thing. It still feels like, okay, people have reproclaimed what they want. here's what I want. I want this fucking pandemic to be over, right? And as a cultural worker, I want for the possibility that I can earn a living again to be a priority for my government. That's just my selfish wants as a cultural worker. But I think in a general way, when a new government, quote unquote, gets into power, people do want to see change. Even if they voted for the same thing, they want to see a renewed sense of energy or a renewed direction. What is it that you are sensing people want from this government most of all?
It's a really hard question. I don't pretend to have my finger on the pulse. You know, I read the Globe and Mail, I read a bit of the Star, and I'm on Twitter, you know, so... You know, my perspective is extremely limited.
Dumb and dumber.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know what people want. People want to be released, as you say, from the pandemic. People want more and more for their lives to go back to the way that they were. People want to get up to zero. Is my basic impression. So a lot of the talk from people about building back better or fixing things or, you know, creating a revolution so that we don't just do the same things again. A lot of that, I figure, was lost on people because what people really just wanted to do was to get back up to zero, was to just get back right to the way that it was hard enough. And then this thing happened. Can we just go back to when it was hard enough? Please.
Well, it reminds me, Michael, of the very first time you were on here, I think, which was maybe our first or second or third show or something. And we had this argument about, you know, I was like, people will abandon art. And you said, well, maybe they should. It's not that important compared to what we're dealing with right now. Like, maybe people just don't have room to think about whether or not theaters will be around because they're fucking locked in their houses trying to survive a deadly pathogen.
Yeah.
Have you seen any more that I was 100% correct?
yes, and I'm happy to come back today.
Has it surprised you how little people give a shit about art?
No, of course not. No, because I lived through the Mike Harris years. I know full well that the people who don't care about art can't be made to care about art. And that's just the way it is. My hot take on all of this is Shaw and Stratford went back too early. What are they doing? Like half-assed out in a tent. I get that people need to work. I get that people are anxious and excited. I get all of it. But what about, and you know, there's no way that my.
Yeah, Kelly Nestruck, shout on you for that.
Went back too
you
early.
You
think they went back too early? Why? Because of health safety reasons, or because you feel like that it was a damn squib and they blew their wad and now they can't come back in a way that will make a difference?
I think it's a little bit of the second one. I just think it's you're in a public health emergency. You have to act like a member of the public. You have to act in the best interest of your fellow citizens, even if it means you starve, you go on CERB, you do whatever. And from my perspective, saying that you're going to open up the Shaw Festival, Stratford Festival in July means that people have to get together and rehearse in May. And they're pissed off because Doug Ford won't tell them whether or not that they can get together and rehearse in May. So my feeling is, you know, everybody says September, 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 everybody's going to be vaxxed. Turned out that that's, you know, Delta fucked that a little bit. But why not hear the public health messaging on September, September, September and aim for a season that runs from October to January in these places and do something, you know, make that plan as opposed to make the plan that looks like you're that is, in fact, a self-serving thing when what you should be doing is trying to support the public health recommendations. That's my only point. Nestor got pissed off at me for saying that. But
that's predicated on the fact that, you know, doing that season, which they lost a lot of money, was really like a difficult kind of like public health situation. And, you know, I saw one of the shows in Stratford, and I like, you had to keep a mask on inside, you were distanced, and you had to take it down to take a sip of like your wine.
Right.
You know, it was by all accounts, no different, if it's probably better than all the other things that people have been allowed to do in this pandemic. And if I always, I viewed it for me as like, it was a big loss, but sometimes, you know, marketing is something that you pay for. And I think perhaps, you know, Stratford and Shaw said to themselves that if we're dark for a whole year, that's just untenable for our brand, or that's untenable for our business. And this is really just like a marketing expense. I don't know.
Yeah, you won't be surprised to hear, Michael, that I don't agree with you. I do, in the sense that I think it was a bummer for everybody trying to rehearse, and that it was, nothing was clear. It's been a summer for people of constant change, constant hassle. They're told one thing one day, another thing another day. It's not a fun way to make art. And I don't think it probably results in art that anybody enjoys much, you know, and that sitting in a little tent with your mask on 20 feet away, that's not fun, right? That, I think we can all agree, that is just, is not fun.
Right.
I guess for my money, I was glad, A, because as you say, people were working, and as someone who's been unemployed for 18 months, I'm just desperate to work. I need to work. I've got to start making some money again. But also because I have always thought along the way in this that we have to make the argument for our necessity, that yes, it is necessary to beat this disease, and it's necessary to take caution. It's also necessary to have a cultural life. It's important. Like, there are health consequences for not having art around. There really are. They are mental, they are physical, they are actual. Art's good for society. So if we're not making that argument by continuing in whatever way we can, then doesn't it make it more difficult to make that argument coming out of it? That it's not just like all or nothing, but that art has to survive no matter what, even when it's not optimal.
I think the only argument for art is good art. I don't know how much fun you had, Allie, seeing that show in Stratford.
It's lovely.
I'm sort of talking, you know, out of both sides of my face here, because I did write something for Shaw, and then went down and saw it performed. I disagree with absolutely nothing that you just said, Torkel, except for I wrote a play in the late 90s called The Drawer Boy, and it was an argument for art. And people saw it, and they got that that was the argument. And because the event of theater worked, I just think that is, that's more valuable than scrambling to do what's possible. I just don't find, the idea of doing a thing in a tent, in a scared, socially distanced, half-ass way, and it's 15 degrees and the rain is pounding down on the top of the tent, I just don't find that a compelling argument for art, as, you know, as art. I find it a compelling argument for employment.
Soft Revolution is brought to you by investwithtim.ca. Folks, there are advanced level financial planning strategies out there, and you don't need a dragon hoard of money to take advantage of them. Talk to Tim about TFSA strategies, life insurance strategies, green investing strategies, about what to do with your RRSPs, about when to take CPP, or what is CPP? Ask about what retirement means to an artist. Come with your good questions and your rookie questions. Bring your spouse and bring your parents. This stuff is important. Check out investwithtim.ca.
I'll tell you that for
free. Well, to go to the employment, that, you know, what's to say, and I always thought about this, you know, we weren't able to get money through the Canadian Emergency Wage Subsidy, which is ridiculous. That's something to think about. And I know the Liberals are considering changing what is employment, particularly in respect to EI. But if you think about it, I mean, Stratford lost millions of dollars on this season. But a lot of these institutions, you know, they've received money through grants and through donors. And I got to say kudos to Crows and Chris. He's been great at this, that the money that he's received from the government, he's really given to like individual artists 100%. To make and do things. And you kind of wonder what would have happened if, like, rather than doing this season, rather than presenting it and losing a shit ton of money. And I will add, when I went to see the show at Stratford, they couldn't even get 100 people to show up. They could not get 100 people to show up to this thing, right? So it wasn't jam-packed. What would have happened if literally, again, now we're going right back to what Jen Lena said, fund artists. What would have happened if Stratford said, you know, we got this money. What we're going to do is we're just going to pay you guys for the year. And you guys just go make art. Go write something. Go do something. Go chill. Go relax. Whatever it is. Put the money back into the pockets of the artists. As opposed to, I think, what Michael, you're saying, to go and do this thing that's like, no matter what, never fully fulfilled. Not 100%.
Yeah. Early in the pandemic, I was inspired by somebody else, and I tweeted that I would, if you were a playwright and you had a play in the works that you wanted and you wanted me to look at it, I would read it and offer notes. And I got dozens and dozens of submissions. I read them all and offered notes. And my suspicion is that there, in the theater, in the text-based theater at least, there is going to be an explosion of art that comes out of this time. You know, there's a real kind of building up of you know, quality stuff out there that's going to explode at some point. Theaters are going to be spoiled for choice in terms of plays to put on, quality plays to put on, difficult, incisive, clever, funny, amazing plays to we're going to be spoiled for the next 10 years.
I completely agree. My fear is about now what has happened to people's risk assessment and the amount of trauma that we've all undergone and how long it will take us to make our audiences unafraid again. You know, I've been announcing shows and we're trying to get shows up in Ontario for our band. And even with vaccine passports, apparently we're still doing capacity limits. So it's like, I don't know how long it's going to take to convince people that it's safe to be in an enclosed room with each other. That's the part that sort of frightens me
You shoulder that a lot. You say it's our responsibility to make people feel comfortable. It's on us to make people feel comfortable to gather. It's not. It's up to the government. It's up to the virus. It's up to these vaccines. It's up to so many things that actually have nothing to do with us. Yeah. And I understand it's difficult because it puts us in a situation in which we are not in control. And that's scary.
Yeah.
But we actually are not in control of whether or not my mother is going to feel comfortable to be with 1,000 people in a theater. That's not up to us.
Well,
you know,
every time you've made this point over the last months, I shout at the speaker. it's just too soon. It's just the thing you want, you're not going to get in the timetable that you want. That's just the way it is. It's just the nature of the pandemic. It's just, you're not going to get, it's just too soon to want people to come back.
This is the nature of my personality, though. People always say this shit to me, and then eventually I do get what I want, and I'm like, okay, but prove to me that having some little terrier fucking barking the whole time did not speed this process up.
Right.
You know, like, you might be right, but the fact of the matter is I've got the energy to yell about it, and I feel like yelling about it at least keeps it on the agenda.
Right. Right. And that's,
you know what I mean?
We'll give you that.
The mistake I constantly make with you, Torque, is that I feel like if I just were to point out something, you would change your mind and take it from 11 down to 6 or 7 and smooth out for the rest of the day. But that is absolutely not your personality. That's not who you are. You absolutely should remain the terrier that you are. But
I got nothing else.
But my impulse always is, imagine what it would have been like for us all to have gone quiet.
I think that's a powerful notion.
For 24 months.
I think that's a powerful notion.
And then the the unbelievable celebration of returning mm-hmm. safely, happily, and enthusiastically to a theater. Can you imagine what that would have been? What would that have meant for the history of the culture in this country? That would have been such an inflection point. Instead, we're back dribs and drabs. And again, I get it. People need to work. These institutions need to survive. I think that many, many institutions have done a good job of trickling the money down, getting our money into our hands so that we can survive as best we can. But can you imagine what it would have been like if there had been no art for 36 months?
It's an interesting question, and I think it points to the kind of inability on a political level, on every level these days, to get any kind of public consensus happening about the way to approach something. You know, not even a vaccine with a 90% effectiveness rate can seem to unite us against this disease, and because of the atomization of the conversation, it is more and more difficult to get any sense of unity around the way to cope with things. And this disease has just exacerbated that. But, I take your point. I think it's a beautiful point. And fortunately, I am profoundly okay with always being wrong. And I always have been. And so I'm left feeling peaceful, despite the fact that I may be completely fucking wrong about everything.
The good news is that people. I just wanted to say
ahead.
The good news is, Torque, is that people are stupid, and so the level
you've
of anxiety.
You've got three great election slogans. I'm going to insist you run. I don't like people. I'm not a party guy. People are stupid. We put them up on giant billboards with your mug next to them. Perfect. I don't see how we lose this.
No, I really don't see how we lose it. But what party do I run for?
The Mike Leely party.
Yeah, of course. when I say stupid, I only mean that fear and anxiety melt away faster than you will believe. So things are truly safe, people will put this behind them in a way that will make your head spin, Torque.
Well, I hope you're right, my friend. And you've been incredibly generous and insightful and lovely as always. The only problem with doing these things and seeing people's faces is then I have this profound sense of missing them and wishing we could have a gin and tonic and yell at each other even more about various things we disagree about. But I love you. You're a wonderful guy and such a great contributor to the cultural conversation. You're generous and you're wise and you're willing to be open. And I think that to me and Ali, that's where we want to start, you know, is just being able to have conversations where we don't agree, but we know that that love is the driving force behind the whole idea of being an artist and making art is sharing love with people. So whatever way we do it, we have to get there. Listen, will you join us for art picks this week before we go?
Sure.
Do you have an art pick? Give us an art pick this week, Michael Healy.
Wow. Here is a like middle-aged white dude, bougie, middle-class art pick.
You don't have to do that. We know you're a middle-aged white bougie guy.
Here's my art pick. Let me just first say, I love you. Torque, I miss you too. Ali, I wish you nothing but success. Anything I can do to help you out. It was great
to spend
time with you yesterday. My art pick is Diana Krall doing A Case of You. Just a beautiful song. We were driving back from up north, and the only thing that shut up the 11-year-old twins was me putting on that, and they were instantly intrigued and then enraptured. So
the sound of mysterious Canadian womanhood right there. Diana
Krall
covering Joni Mitchell.
One of the greatest songs.
Yeah, incredible.
Sure. Ever written.
Ali, what's yours?
Oh, there you go.
Proud by Michael Healy.
Now,
he didn't prepare that, by the way, folks.
No,
Ali is holding up a copy of Michael Healy's play Proud. You just been reading it lately? Tell us a bit about it.
Yeah, I just started reading it recently, and it's interesting. Michael, what is it? It's about the conservatives. They win a majority in 2011, And I never got a chance to see this at Shaw.
Right.
So what is it? There's a prime minister. There's like he realizes there's like this like this single mother, Gisbella Lyth.
Lyth, yes.
Lyth, pardon me.
Not at all.
And it's just all about like how can we create like this like scandal, this thing to like, you know, get this bad boy moving. And I've just started reading it. Because I was so sad that I got to miss it at Shaw with so many great people who I really love and just hanging out with you. And I actually stole this from George Brown Theater School.
So, beautiful.
Yeah, beautiful. And it's just, it's really funny. It really just like pops.
One of the things Michael does that's very important, I think, as a playwright is there should be more like him. Like in Britain, there's a lot more guys and ladies like Michael, people who are willing to take on politics as a drama and as a kind of ideal setting for comedy, for tragedy, yes, for human idiocy. And in that way, they demystify the political process for people. They take it down a notch. And I think it's good for, it's not just good for like laughs. It's good for democracy for people to write political plays. So if you haven't read Michael's political plays, and you're bored by politics, read Michael's plays, because to me, they make politics about humans and not about policies. And ultimately, that's what it is. Stephen Harper, yeah, as much of a dead-eyed sociopath as he is, had a mother, and I want to know what the fuck was wrong with her.
Yeah.
Anyway.
And the thing about this is 2011, and this is basically about how politics is really, it's like a bunch of humans and a bunch of like, it's a shit show. And here in 2021, it's like, it's a shit show. It's and it makes me think that it's always been a shit show. It will always be a shit show.
Yeah. La plus perpetuity. Ça change, la plus c'est la même chose. Ooh. Translate that, Aaron O'Toole. Okay. My art pick is weird this week. I've been really obsessed. I've been alone in this house in North Hatley, which my great-great-grandfather built 120 years ago. And it's not winterized, so it's getting progressively colder and colder. And I'm completely alone here. I've been alone more than I've been in years and years and years. And I've gone through various stages of insanity. But I've also become obsessed with ghosts. And I found out recently that my great-great-grandfather on my father's side, whose name was John Sloan, was a spirit medium. And he was very famous, apparently, for doing voices, for speaking in the voices of the dead that he was, wow, trying to communicate with. Well, that's an actor, right? So I was fascinated by the notion that I too, had I been more enterprising, could have probably gotten a good business going as a spirit medium. And I've started watching seances on YouTube. If you're into this, what, kind of thing, yeah, there's tapes of seances on YouTube. And they are beautiful. They're very beautiful and very moving. Because whether you believe in them or not, they are people in an act of faith. And that to me is what art is, right? It's a leap of faith. You try and create something out of nothing. You use funny voices, you use lights, you use melodies, you use words, whatever you got, you throw it at this act of faith. And a lot of the time you can fool them. And so for me, it's been just a nice reminder of what Michael, you were talking about, which is that at the end of the day, there will be this pent-up desire, this longing to participate in some ridiculous act of faith. And that's where we'll come in, you know? So go watch some seances on YouTube, people. It'll cheer you up. That's Soft Revolution for this week. Michael Healy, the brilliant and kind Michael Healy, we love you. Thank you so much for joining us again. Please don't be a stranger. Will you come back and talk about how badly the Trudeau government is doing in about 6 months?
Of course. Happy to do it. Love it.
Just all right. Give my love to all your family and love out there to all of you. Stay strong. If you have people in your life who won't get vaccinated, just smile at them condescendingly. Let's try that this week and see if that works. Love you all. We'll see you next week.
On the back of a cartoon coaster, in the blue TV screen light, I drew a map of Canada, oh Canada. With your face sketched on twice, oh, you're in my blood. blood like holy wine. It tastes so bitter and it tastes so sweet. Ooh, I could drink a case of you, darling, and still be on my feet. I'd still be on my feet. Oh, I am a lonely. I live in a box of paints. I'm frightened by the devil, and I'm drawn to those who ain't afraid. I remember the time you told me love is touching souls. Surely you touch mine. Part of you pours out of me in these lines from time to time. Oh, you're in my blood like holy wine. It tastes so bitter and it tastes so sweet. Oh, I could drink a case of you. I could drink a case of you, darling, and still be on my feet. Still be on my feet. I met a woman, she had a mouth like yours. She knew your life. She knew your devils and your deeds. She said, go to him, stay with him if you can. But be prepared to bleed. Oh, you're in my blood like holy wine. It tastes so bitter and it tastes so sweet. Oh, I could drink a case of you, darling, and still be on my feet. I'd still be on my feet.